That night, I was ready to be king.
Welcome to Radio DMG. I am your host, Phil Wesley, the Mile High Mouth, and you're listening to Radio DMG on May 30th, 2013. So today, what do we have for you? Well, we're going to be covering Denver Comic Con this weekend instead of A-Con, because, hey, lack of fundage, brah. But hey, guess what? We're going to have some neat announcements upcoming in this June. But yeah, from this weekend, we're going to be covering Denver Comic Con, and you'll see new photos and video and hopefully audio and articles on the website. Yes, it'll be good. It's going to be fun, but let's get down to business to what we're going to do in this episode of Radio DMG. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to have our first of our sauna coverage, which is an audio bit from Dr. Lisa Friedman. And if you open up our Flickr coverage of sauna, you can actually follow along when she moves slides by following along with Flickr, which, by the way, they optimize Flickr for tablets, and it looks okay, I guess. Anywho, it's not going to change our coverage using it, though. And, yeah, we've got all that coming up. We have this audio from, we have that audio, then a musical ration, and then a long-standing tradition with Radio DMG and conventions. So that's pretty much it. That's what we've got on the docket. I'm going to go ahead and just start playing the feature.
University of Oregon. I don't know if anyone else has come out from Oregon. Yay, thank you. That's right, Allie's here. My presentation style, again, I will bombard you with PowerPoints. And can you hear me? Just wave at me if I'm going too quickly or if there's anything you'd like to see again. Like the first slide was actually, this is one of my colleagues that I teach with. She's a Chinese language instructor who is amazing at cosplay and two of our undergrads. So since I'm going first, I'm going to make some introductory remarks that I hope will guide today's discussion. Based on years of teaching Japanese popular culture in the United States and Japan, I will discuss how the popularity of anime has changed universities, giving rise to new curriculums, and redefining education. I would love to hear your views as students, teachers, creative producers, event planners, and other busy people. I will make some suggestions on how to teach anime but my larger focus is on strategies to encourage discussion about the political and social significance of popular culture. I hope that these suggestions will benefit anime fans working in education and other fields. And I just love the reaction from the audience. We were talking about this upstairs with the other presenters about fans and how you trade in knowledge and how knowledge brings us together. So please do giggle at the slides. My theory is these are actually my students. Students born in the 1990s have had greater access to anime than earlier generations and have engaged with it more intimately than other cultural forms. My classes explore how this generation has used anime as a means to learn about Japan and their own places in the world. Japan is an important case study in how transnational fandoms shape national images. So my classes draw a variety of students, ranging from those specializing in Japanese culture and language to those who have never taken a course on Japan. And again, my classes fulfill general requirements. Most of my students were interested in Japanese popular culture before entering universities, and some are avid fans. Others are less involved but equally curious. Many students, how many of you are college students here? Oh, wow. How many of you are majors in Japanese studies? Yeah, that's what I thought. One. Which is very interesting how people from all across the board, from, I don't know, what are your majors? Just yell out.
My MFA is in marketing.
Excellent.
Industrial design.
Amazing. Here's great. Culinary arts, wow. I love how popular culture anime brings people together in various ways, and I'd like to hear how you use anime in your careers and your lives. The added benefit of my career is I get to teach things I love and discuss things that I'm passionate about. And my own research, I deal with media depictions of new gender roles and the ways digital technologies have redefined notions of books, literature, and popular culture. And you all probably have noticed this, and I noticed the Hello Kitty earrings, which I really like. Cute characters are always looking at you because it forms sort of an emotional bond between the viewer and the character. A theory that I teach in my classes, and we could talk about, as texts like anime change in the digital age, so do the ways that we consume and study them. New degrees are evolving around the world, not just in the United States, but in Japan and elsewhere, that include anime. For example, the University of Oregon just started a new minor, which will probably become a major, in comics and cartoon studies. But I'm lobbying to add the words manga and anime to the title. Yay. Some additional themes I explain to students are how studying anime is a good way to learn about society, international studies, politics, law, economics, art, literature, psychology, and more. I'm just going to go through some slides to give some background that we could discuss about the global flow of Japanese popular culture in general. And again, please feel free to stop me at any time, or we could save some time for questions at the end. Popular culture, which is never neutral, teaches us much about the value of the society that produces and consumes it. It helps construct images of Japan at home and abroad. Japanese fashions, games, anime, manga, music, toys, and more have spread worldwide and have created a new form of national superpower. Hello Kitty, arguably the most recognizable icon in the world, was made tourism ambassador to Asia. Ambassadors are usually people. But you can think about having a cute character to represent places, events, and concepts. Make these events, like a Hello Kitty representing Japan, erases other things that Japan might negatively be known for. So cute characters as softening sterner associations. Doraemon, I don't know if, it's fun because many of my students from Asia know Doraemon perhaps more than Hello Kitty, but in the United States, vice versa. This blue cat, Doraemon, was made anime ambassador in the same year, 2008, to teach other countries the value of anime and to deepen interest in Japanese culture. So words like anime, sushi, otaku are listed in global dictionaries, and the suffix zilla has long been around to describe things in American slang. Women and men of different age groups around the world have used Japanese popular culture to form new communities, make statements about gender and identity, and to overturn cultural stereotypes. Japanese popular culture often equals youth culture in the global imagination, and urban culture too. Anime has promoted the image of Tokyo, especially the Tokyo neighborhood of Akihabara, as the capital of cool. One question that I ask my students and we discuss is, what makes Japanese popular culture so fascinating? How have anime characters transformed global politics and the ways people construct their own identities? Are there any negatives to regarding Japan as the capital of cool? Will Japan always retain this association? And if so, how will Japan be able to do this? Another question I ask, and we were discussing earlier, is it more important to study Japanese popular culture today in the digital age? Or let me rephrase that, not more important, but different. Arguably, more people around the world access Japanese popular culture, especially anime and manga, online. But the global flow of Japanese popular culture is not new. For example, Godzilla was arguably one of the first Japanese films to go commercial in the United States. But as you know, not the original Godzilla. I don't know if anyone has seen the original 1954 Godzilla. It's fantastic, which is an anti-war, anti-nuclear movie. But the American Godzilla, which was re-edited and re-released just a few months later, erases all of that political meaning. It's just sort of a silly monster suit destroying Japan. Astro Boy was the first Japanese television program to be popular around the world, and many people in the United States, for example, didn't know it was from Japan. Astro Boy was the most popular program on American television in February 1964. And when you think about it, anime was among the first television programs to be globalized. Cartoons in general are easy to localize. You could just erase the sound and create a new dubbing in another language. This is, I don't know if anyone has watched the 1974 Heidi, but was actually one of the first Japanese anime to be popular in Europe. And there's also examples of American culture going into Japan, like the Powerpuff Girls, my favorites, became Powerpuff Girls Z in Japan in 2006-2007.
Oh, you should see it.
You can see how the aesthetics have changed. So in the digital age, images circulate more rapidly in different ways. They are more quickly removed from their original home and placed in new context. And I'm glad you recognize all the characters here. My undergraduate courses are premised on the notion that students born in the 1990s are consuming popular culture differently than those born in earlier generations. They are nostalgic about their own childhoods differently. That's the biggest one of the biggest lessons I've learned from my students. This is in part due to their lifelong access to digital culture. And again, the internet is one of the first places that many people go to these days to access new anime. But the American generation who came of age in the 1980s, my generation still had memories of the negative effects of the Japanese economy or fears. I remember images of Toyotas being burned in California, television sets. This is an image that sort of unifies youth in the United States. Pokemon and other characters, like, this is my worst nightmare. Huge Hello Kitty. But floating above it in such iconic American events as the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. Pop culture is a means to unify children worldwide. So some reference points in the consumption of anime online. When you think about it, Steve Jobs unveiled the Mac to the world in 1984. And notice one of the first screens as being a geisha. YouTube recently started in 2005, and Nico Nico Douga, the Japanese video sharing site, in 2006. Facebook and Mixi in 2004, Mixi being one of the Japanese social networking sites that's now not as popular because of Facebook. As I mentioned again, and I'll repeat myself a bit because I know it's early morning and I'm showing a lot of slides, students have engaged with manga and anime more intimately than other cultural forms. They've copied their visual styles, translated and extended their narratives, and have started internet memes, have circulated their creations for other fans to appreciate. Fans challenge Japan's dominant strategies of adopting successful international formulas, but not internationalizing its own culture because the domestic market is strong enough. What I'm trying to teach my students is that it's important for them to think about how they appropriate Japanese trends to fully understand the role of the internet in the globalization of culture. Is what fans do always legal? We have to think about where we get our materials and the ramifications of this. Another thing that I try to make my students understand is some of the trends that we think of as epitomizing Japan are not necessarily always the trends that are most popular in Japan. For example, a few years ago, there was a huge fad in Japan for roll cake. And that was one of the biggest things people stood in line for in Japan. But roll cake has never become as popular in the United States, even though it's really delicious. The Japanese government, especially around the year 2010, began leveraging global fandoms to improve the domestic economy, adapting such policies as the Cool Korea policies and Cool Taiwan policies to promote Cool Japan, sort of boosting the domestic economy through the circulation of popular culture. But this also led to certain censorship or different policies regulating the content and the distribution of popular culture internationally. A lot of the popular culture we consume, I'm throwing out lots of ideas that we could all string together throughout the day, is kawaii, or this notion of cute that's premised on being vulnerable and needing to take care, being taken care of. Not all, but a lot of the Japanese culture that's being promoted abroad is based on this idea of kawaii, this idea of sort of needing our help, needing us as much as we need them. A lot of these Japanese policies boosting the circulation of popular culture has gone over the buzzword of soft power. As one of my students put it, hard power is using force to get people to do what you want. Soft power is you're so cute, people want to do it for you. This idea culture can promote better international relations. But it also has led to certain backlashes. Like, one of my favorite blogs is Hello Kitty Hell, the overload of living with too much cute. I don't know if anyone has browsed this. A challenge I pose to my students, and again, I'll pose this to you, if you could find something Hello Kitty is not on, I'm stuck. Yeah, she's on almost everything. She was also on the space shuttle. She's everywhere. Yeah. But are we living in a global moment of cute? Former images of Japan, like earlier generations in the 1940s, 1950s, even earlier in the early 20th century, may have thought of Japan not as being a country of popular culture, but or another form of popular culture, maybe being a country of cherry blossoms and geisha, or other stereotypes that might not encapsulize all of what Japan really is. Because my courses on Oregon, especially those for freshmen, we study popular culture in English, we discuss why certain texts translate more easily across time periods and cultures. Like, for example, One Piece is a good example of how things translate across eras. Many American universities and universities in Japan have started special courses that focus on anime and manga in particular. And if you browse online, you can find lots and lots of posters advertising summer programs. I'm not promoting the Meiji University program, but this is one example. I'm going to skip ahead a bit because I'd like to save time for questions, but one of the things that I do, I'll leave this slide up. I was thinking maybe those of you, I'd like to get your views of why anime is so popular, so attractive. And I was thinking in terms of Miyazaki Hayao's anime, which have arguably been some of the most globalized, commercialized anime products around the world. Anime is a media that represents sort of identity flows in different ways. Anime of having strong female characters that other media, perhaps live action film, lack, novels even lack. The importance of youth characters, or anime's being a space for adults to be children for a little bit of time. Anime often comment on social problems, but not in a means to change the world per se, but to make us aware of what might be going on in certain social structures. Its relationship to manga, toys, video games, fashion, and more. Also, anime is visually stunning. And one thing we could think about is what does the media of anime do that other media cannot? So anime is also a media that depicts student life and has many student characters. So we tackle these themes and questions in my classes in a variety of ways. And I'm trained as a literature person. I'm also a historian and film studies, so I'm grounded in text. To cover several topics in a short academic time, and I'll go over some, I don't know if you're interested in pedagogy, but I'll just quickly, if you're interested in how some of these things are incorporated into the classroom. I take a case study approach in my class, and I look at key texts that have transformed the production and consumption of anime. Class meetings are often full of discussion, but I like to talk, so I lecture the students. It's also, I don't require students to know Japanese language, but if you know Japanese language, it does help. I don't know how many of you are studying Japanese, but I am always flexible, and I end up changing the syllabus to adapt to the interests of the students. I'm going to show you lots of pictures of my students, so if you see them, you know, that might embarrass them. We also go on field trips, even, you know, strange places like cafeterias, dorms, to see how anime culture is working its way into student life. Here we are in one of the campus museums. But our class topics include, for example, this idea of cool Japan, especially after the March 11th, 2011 triple disaster of earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear meltdown. We talk about the idea of safe Japan, how anime has used to promote tourism again. We also talk about ideas of soft power. We talk about anime in different forms, even sort of fan-produced, sort of other anime. One of the questions I'm fascinated in my own research is, how do we use popular culture to teach children? And how do we do this by, do we want to scare them, or do we want to soothe them, or both? We could also think about sort of mainstream anime in this effect, too. We talk about how Japanese characters have changed the world, Godzilla again being an anti-war monster, Hello Kitty is Japan's ambassador to Asia, and Doraemon perhaps is Asia's friend. And what fascinates me too is when I show some of these characters, I love the reaction of students. The students from Hong Kong, Singapore, all over Asia know Doraemon very closely, having the anime being broadcast widely in Asia, but my students from the United States do not understand why this cat doesn't have ears. Actually, they were bitten off by a mouse. We also talk about key producers, such as the famous Tetsuo Osamu, or maybe infamous, depending on who you are, in the manga anime world, and Miyazaki Hayao. And the ability of, for example, Miyazaki Hayao's anime to reach audiences of all ages and both genders, or all genders. This is very rare for culture to be able to do this. We talk about the idea of why anime has so many kid characters, and the idea that children can be superheroes. We also got into this really interesting discussion about why kids fly, in part because they're too young to drive. And we also talked about, for example, how Astro Boy has been readapted into different contexts, including, in my opinion, the not-so-great 2009 American version, and the sort of the optimism for nuclear power that's depicted in the manga especially, and the cross-media promotion flows as early as the 1960s. I really like teaching Kiki's Delivery Service, or it's one of my favorites. And it's fun to hear how the students use anime, especially Miyazaki Hayao, to construct their own nostalgia for their own events in their lives. We talk about the images of schoolgirls and schoolboys in anime, also different kinds of images of boyhood. I'm interested in hearing more about people's views of Akira this afternoon. I draw upon my students to help teach the unit on fashion. And here are members of the Oregon Lolita community. Yeah, they made me dress in classic Lolita. Or they should say they made me. They dressed me up last week. It was a lot of fun. We talk about otaku, sort of avid fans. Now especially the term used for avid fans of digital media, manga, anime. And the gender politics of the academic fields that have been constructed around them. We also talk about how digital media has formed new communities and the power of fans. And we touch on a little bit of slash and yaoi culture, especially sort of pairing fictional characters together, especially male characters together. And I love teaching Death Note in this respect. This is Ian's work. We talk about Hatsune Miku, sort of virtual pop stars, and the world of fan art. We also talk about global internet memes and the roles of anime in them. And how global fans, both legally and not, have changed the consumption of anime. Copyright laws. The connection between anime and video games. So those are what I teach. In the last 2 minutes, I'd just like to go over the so what questions. So the students get this information, what do they do with it? The general skills I'd like the students to cultivate, especially in my undergraduate classes, and I do teach graduate students too, is to think critically about anime and other popular cultures, to better express their thoughts about it in orally and in writing, to analyze different artistic media, to become familiar with local resources. Again, I mean Tokyo or Oregon, where I'm usually teaching about the study of Japan, to see how their coursework relates to larger pictures of their own lives, to learn to better use technology, and we do a lot of things online, and to cultivate skills outside of the classroom. Some example assignments that use anime. I encourage students to post on our social networking site. And in my fall class, we ended up with 200 photos and 100 videos related to the class. And we also do weekly posts in which the students engage with class readings and texts. We keep collective bibliographies that we download, sort of thoughts about what we're learning. And students are required to post at least one text a week about something they've read. Midterms, also to entertain myself, I like when they're creative. But a requirement I have for the students, if they want to do an interpretive dance based on Akira, they have to post it online for at least 6 months. Anything that's done creatively on digital media has to be posted for the public to consume. And in fact, this was a video that one of my students created based on cell phone novels and Godzilla together that it was picked up in a class at the University of Texas as a teaching material. We also do short participation exercises. I require at least 5 times of the term students to bring something in. This is in part because my classes tend to become very loud and exuberant, and I want to make sure everybody has a chance to be heard. And this is a way for fans to share their knowledge and to think about what they consume as both academics and fans. As I try to enforce to the students that it's not me that's leading the class, it's really them. That the success of a class is based as much on the students as it is on the teacher. For example, these exercises, the students have to bring something in of what they see about Japanese anime culture, Japanese pop culture around campus. I have them create characters based on things in their own lives. This is one assignment. They have to create a character based on a fear, both public or private fear. And you can see my freshmen are scared of doing their homework. Final projects are specialized to allow students to build skills they have or want to cultivate. They could write a research paper, they could do a video, they could do an artwork. I've had people do lunchbox art. But the goal is for students to build on what they know now and what they'd like to do in the future. I don't want them to create a paper they just delete from their computers and never look at again. I want this project to be useful. Some general things that I encourage them to do, an annotated bibliography based on our class bibliographies, a research paper, a blog, ethnographic report, or a creative project. Most students choose blog, actually, and the blogs are still up. I check them periodically. But if they do a creative project, they have to provide me with liner notes so I can understand what the goals are of the project. So in the past, I've had students do ethnographic films of anime cons, and these are photos from an anime convention in Singapore. One student did a manga that is still currently online about how to dress in cosplay. The same student also has created a website for learning Japanese language based on manga and anime, and that's still up there. I could give you information if you want. This is a student who created a guidebook to Pokemon. But one of the things students learn by doing this project is how challenging and rewarding teaching can be. Some of the student art. More about their documentaries. This is one student who's created a how-to website for character bento, character lunch boxes. So this is about, I'll skip ahead, this is just sort of a list of topics I've created, but in class evaluations, one of the things that makes me happy is that students have learned both the breadth and extent of anime, Japanese popular culture. They've learned to think that anime is more than they expected it was, or is. And they've also learned that the things they consume for fun have social, political significances. And they've become more familiar with digital media, and I've been impressed by their critical thinking skills that they've developed. I'm going to stop there, but I'd be glad to talk about how I've taken what I've taught in the United States and also transformed it to large classes. I teach at Waseda University, for example. And one of the challenges I face in teaching in Japan is how to teach students from many different countries. The way I've learned is to let the students teach. We've had great discussions on the consumption of anime in Sweden, for example, or Japanese television programs in Cambodia. So I'd just like to open it up for questions and discussions. And thank you. If you have a particular slide I'd be glad to bring it back if you'd like to look at it longer.
How do
hoping you guys can answer that too. We can all answer it together this afternoon. Yeah, and thanks for throwing this out, because I hope that everybody begins to answer. How do I answer, why is anime so popular? I usually answer back with the question, you know, why do you like it? What do you do with it? So what does it exist? I've seen anime, perhaps I'm old, I mean, I'm definitely older than my students, even though I like to think that I'm the same age. But I've seen anime go through different waves in my own lifetime of how it's consumed. I think it's popular in part because of the fans. Fans make it so. It's popular because it's different from other media. It has different kinds of characters, different kinds of narratives. You could do things with it that you can't do with characters from live action film. You could participate more, for example, in anime. It's also cool, the trading in knowledge. You could see different things. I mean, maybe if I ask a film historian, maybe a film historian will say some of the same things, but I believe that there's things anime can do that live action film cannot. I don't know if that's a satisfactory answer, but we'll keep hashing this out, especially in the closing discussion. In the middle and then in the back.
For your class, do you, with global media transfer, as you were talking about, do you focus on anime and define it as anime because of its source being from Japan?
Excellent question.
Or are you looking at it as an art style, in which case, how do you deal with the fact that the anime art style is
excellent question. You're the industrial design major? Yeah, that's an excellent question. I would sort of favor the latter part, that anime is being a style that originated in Japan, but it's been incorporated into different media, even though some of you might argue differently. And I think fan-produced anime has been fascinating, or even things that combine certain aesthetics of classical Disney cartoons and anime in really creative ways. And anime, as you know, is not just... I mean, anime is a larger character, like say, like category, like saying fiction or novels or... And there's so many different kinds of anime within it. But the aesthetics of anime, I mean, there is a certain aesthetic that you could pick out, for example, is manga being different from comic books in the speech bubbles, in the kinds of frames, things like that. Anime has the same kind of transference. But I think it is important to think about where anime started and how it started. And I'd love to hear your views more later as a designer, too. Yes. I keep going back to one of my favorite examples. Maybe we can hear more about this afternoon, of Akira in the 1980s. And how Akira, for example, in 1988, being one of the first anime to sort of go global in certain ways. In a different way than Pokemon in 1995, or Miyazaki Hayao films, especially after Totoro in the late 1980s, early 1990s. For example, in the 80s, before the internet, now the internet's wonderful because we could have anything instantly. And, you know, I would get into so much trouble if I posted my slides. I mean, there are 97 slides of images I've taken offline. But that's just one key example I'd like to think about how the internet is changing, how we can instantly get a hold of something. Also, the internet gives us the freedom of participating in anime in different ways than in the 1980s. In the 1980s, the first, I guess, maybe the co-presenters will know more about this than I do. In the 1980s, if you wanted to see an anime, you'd have to see it on video, even before DVDs, or try to find some kind of con or limited theatrical release. But now we can even get, you know, old cartoons that weren't widely distributed. Like, I saw the whole Heidi series from 1974 online. Not the whole thing. I couldn't sit through the whole thing. But I guess the consumption patterns have changed since the 1980s, the technology for both producing and distributing. So much has changed, even before that, 1960s, 1970s. So I don't know if I'm answering your question fully, but I'd love to hear what other people think about that.
I was thinking, you know, we bring back Transformers. And
yeah. Pokemon keeps going and going and going. I wonder what next color is going to come out. There's a new Pokemon film almost every year. But I love the nostalgia, especially for the 1980s. And that's something I'm trying to piece out. Why has the 80s become such a big force of nostalgia these days?
I'm not. But there's a 20-year, 30-year rule that I I've learned in life, and no matter where we are, it's 20 years ago. Kids who were 5 years old, they're now 20 and 25, and they have a nostalgia for what they had. So that's why anything, wherever year you're in, it's always, you know, 20, 30 years before that.
Thanks. Yes, over there in what?
I'd like to speak to the answer.
Should I pass this around?
Huh?
Should I pass the mic around?
He's coming up.
Well, I'd like to speak actually to the answer to that, because originally I started in anime collecting it in back in 1984.
Wow.
And so our group and everything at that time in Denver was called Seafood. Seafood was CFO of Colorado, or Denver, Colorado. And my first experiences of animation and everything were through collecting. I mean, we could only get it from friends that sent it from Japan, putting it on tapes and different stuff and bringing it to us. And my love of it came from the art and the style that was put into it, because one of the examples I use is I used to watch the Flintstones and Scooby-Doo, and you know, you'd watch them run across this surface or an area. Was a Flintstone. Whenever he walked into the door, he could walk directly from his front yard, in the front door, through the front room, into the kitchen. When he came back, he came right across through and then went into the bedroom. You know, it was all flat. It was all direct. When I saw Japanese animation, there was the character actually walking away from you. The character actually coming towards you. My favorite movie, which obviously disturbs a lot of my friends, is a movie called Angel's Egg. And in it, it was the first time I'd ever seen a character run out of a scene. She ran away from us, and me and a friend were sitting there, and the next thing you know, she jumped up and disappeared. And we both jumped off the couch and she fell. You know, I mean, was it, you had Roadrunner and all that different sort of stuff, and they literally, you know, he'd stand in the air and everything, didn't realize it, and then gravity would take him. But you know, most of it came from that, and specifically the first time I saw Akira, watching the movie going on, and then there was one scene in there where Akira's the secondary character was with a girl, and you're watching them as they're talking, and then you start noticing that the camera is pulling back, and you can watch as the fence is moving against the background, different from where it was. It was like, there's a camera, there's a view, it's actually like it was inside the situation, looking at it. And for all animation up until then that I'd ever seen, it was like, okay, we're seeing the situation going on. You can actually get the feeling that there's a camera taking a position, looking at it from inside the scene. And so that's what I came to actually love about anime, and then the rest of the stories came in from there. But yeah, it was the art style that got to me.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Thank you. I just learned a lot.
I'm outside of that 1990s age group just by a little bit, but I was kind of curious, we consume differently, but I'm also wondering how we participate differently.
Excellent question.
Yeah. If that's what causes the change, because I know I still really like collecting DVD box sets, and I get all the manga, and then I get the special edition of the manga. I don't know if necessarily the 1990s and Beyond group does that, and I'm curious if that's something we need to be pushing more for them, or if it's just something that's going to change eventually to where all media is digital and we just kind of have to deal with it.
Yeah. No, I hope there's something about the endurance of the cultural artifact of the book or the DVD. I love holding a video cassette up to my class and asking them, like, what is this? But I think you're right. I mean, and I'm so glad that people have mentioned collecting, because I hope that's a theme that we can continue to discuss today about how the nature of a lot of the anime production consumption is also collection.
Thanks.
you had some very interesting comments about the kind of the way anime provides an opportunity for a more intimate engagement with the material. I wanted to suggest one other possibility or one other factor for its popularity may be the fact that by its nature, anime provides a certain distance in that compared to other audiovisual media, it being drawn and stylized compared to live action, and for North American audiences, it having a certain cultural and linguistic difference, it offers in some ways maybe a safer way, especially for younger audiences, to engage with materials or with topics, with subject matter that would be a little more challenging if they were dealing with it in something that was more direct, like a live action native to their own culture, or might be a little embarrassing to engage with. So you have things like, you know, sex and drugs and violence. You also have things like ambition and romance that are not problematic as such, but maybe more embarrassing. So to that extent, the way that anime is a little bit more distant and therefore allows you to interpret it a little more freely if you're an audience without that connection to it, without that cultural connection. And as part of that, it seems to me that anime fandom as a movement was right in step with the acknowledgement and recognition of where anime came from. In my generation, you know, my friends and I, big fans of Astro Boy and Gigantor, but there was no Astro Boy fandom the way even at the time there was a Star Trek fandom. When anime was recognized as something from Japan and something with a certain source, then that seemed to be part and parcel of what allowed this fandom to grow.
I hope we can discuss issues of proximity and distance, too. Yeah. Thank you.
I actually want to kind of say something about the 1980s versus the 1990s, and because it's interesting, because the people that run conventions are generally the older generation with the 80s and older, and I think you have to be a hardcore fan or at least a hardcore fan of the fans to even want to do a convention. And I don't know about any of you guys, but when we found out about Sana, how many of you guys had discussions at home with, you know, your staff and your people, you know, well, why is anime popular? And I think a lot of it is one of the things that was brought up in 1982, the U.S. had lifted regulations that people could actually target the younger audience for products and cartoons and stuff, and I think that's why anime kind of slid right into there so easily, was because they were already doing that and they were experts at it, and America's still kind of trying to learn about that, so I guess that's my point.
I'm glad you mentioned 1982.
I just wanted to make a quick comment about a way that I really think that the anime fandom is changing in America. Is, by the way, I'm Sully from Funimation. One of the things that we're noticing is especially the explosive growth amongst millennials in anime fandom. And one of the big roadblocks that we personally hit within the industry is the fact that they consume media very differently from the way that any other generation has in the past. Mm-hmm. They're used to having it now, being able to find it wherever they want it, having faster download speeds, and they don't want to pay for it, quite honestly. It's because they came up within a generation where so much of this was available on BitTorrent and that kind of thing, and because of the unique nature of anime and the fact that there are so many titles that are not licensed within the United States, it was fairly easy for things like fan subs to really come up with this new generation. Fan subs for us were even more difficult to get a hold of when back when dinosaurs roamed the earth and most of us became anime fans, because of the nature of getting it onto a VHS tape and distributing it and that kind of thing. For the most part, it was something that we were doing in our living rooms with our friends so that we were able to have access to some of these shows. But we were purchasing, for by and large, the product legally from Japan because it was the only way to get it. Nowadays, you're running into a lot of people that are wanting to be able to consume this media, but they're not willing to wait. the way that we had to. For example, I had mentioned earlier today when I was chatting with some folks in the green room, is one of the things that we run into a lot now is you've got these kids that are like, it came out 3 months ago in Japan. Why don't you have a dub out yet? And 3 months? Try 3 years. Because that's what we used to have to wait for a dub or for a release of some form or fashion. Yeah. On top of the fact that you were able to get this, or then it finally comes out, you've got two episodes on a crappy VHS, and it's only the dub. You don't have the option of watching
it. And it's 34.
So I think we've all had a lot of kids these
retail
days
here.
I like to call them get off my lawn moments. But in addition to that, you're also dealing with parents that because of this, the amount of media that these kids are being exposed to, you're dealing with parents that assume that because it's cartoons, it's safe. And that is a huge problem that I have been running into. One of the things that I do at conventions is a class that's called Anime and Manga 101 for Parents, What's Up with All the Nosebleeds? It's basically an opportunity for all of the parents to ask the questions they don't want to ask their kids because they don't want to look stupid. But a lot of this ties into the fact that these kids are then, they're experiencing this media and then they're going to university and they're wanting to study this more in depth, and I can't tell you how excited I am to see programs like Dr. Friedman's where these children are able to go, these kids are able to go in a way that we were never able to when we were younger. So I love the fact that this new technology is both really, really bolstering the environment and bolstering the genre, but by the same time, it's also one of its biggest detractors. So anyway, I'll shut up.
Yeah, there's a lot of questions. Should we keep going with questions?
Yeah, sure.
I should be taking notes on your opponents so much.
Looking at it from a design perspective, another thing anime has, though, is the fact that anime is more than just the media itself. It teaches almost a secondary language within it, and then it has products to go with it. How many of my friends who watch Dragon Ball Z would then stand on the playground and go, Hame, Kame, and do that? And there's products. The only other things that have anything close to an anime like Fandom America are other things with product lines similar. Star Wars, you can go out and buy yourself lightsabers. You can't do that for a lot of other American media, but Japanese media, it's common. You wind up with, here's plastic versions of all the characters' toys and gadgets and everything. And that aspect pulls it in and makes it much more of a language that can be used to communicate between people and a secondary connection. Because you can be watching it, but you turn around, and when you're not watching it, you still have on your cell phone the charm from it or something else. It pulls in the audience in another way, and so anime becomes more than just the animation, but it becomes a series of items and therefore connections, since we're humans.
Ownership. Personal ownership.
Mm-hmm. And for the collection aspect, before your ownership was the VHS with the copy, but now the media itself is this digital cloud out there, and so the ownership becomes the product, and that's your connection.
Interesting. Yeah, the cross-media promotion aspects are fascinating. I also like how fans create products, too, that might not exist.
When a product doesn't exist, fans create it because they still want that
thing. Yeah. One more question. I forget. There was someone in the back that raised a hand. No? Oh, and over here's got it.
But speaking especially, I think, with digital media and with people not wanting to buy anime or buy manga, what do you think about, I want to say new models of buying, if you're familiar with, I believe, Crunchyroll?
Yes.
Does it where the week after they sub it? And so I wonder what you think about fragmentation of fans in the sense that nowadays I can go find the most craziest niche anime I want to, and even then I can get it a week later. in Japanese, and how do you think that changes the way we interact with, like, dubs or even with older series that we can't get that quickly?
Yeah, and you're raising some really important issues about the roles of fans in globalizing niche media, turning them into mainstream media, and some of the differences get blurred between the creators and the producers and consumers. I'm fascinated by fan subs and scanlations, and Crunchyroll is being, like, one of the, I guess, biggest culprits or biggest promoters, no matter how you look at it from which side of the industry, and the evolution that Crunchyroll's gone through, too, the trouble that, for example, Manga Fox and other sites got into, especially in 2011. Yeah, I heard the oohs there. But yeah, I think fans have played a large role, and it's also, our Japanese language program has grown so much at UO, too, because people want to learn how to fan sub and scan late. And I know some language instructors are even using fan subs as an assignment in class, which is interesting. I'd love to hear more about the fans' perspective on that. Thank you. This is going to be a great discussion today.
Thank you.
Up another episode of Radio DMG, but before we do, there is a tradition that we do before every convention, and that is to pray about it. Now, if you're not religious, you can just skip this. Just do whatever. Heathen. Anyways, if you're not religious, whatever. But if you are, that's fine too. Anyways, here's what we're going to go ahead and do. Not going to apologize for this, so if you're offended or you feel threatened by prayer, reevaluate your life and reevaluate what you're really offended about. I mean, seriously, people are dying in the streets in many other countries and you're offended because I pray? Something's wrong with you. Anywho, dear God, tomorrow we're going to embark on a trip over to Denver Comic Con 2013, and we won't be able to go to Akon this year, but please bless everyone going to Akon and Denver Comic Con this year. Give them safe passage, a safe trip, help everyone to stay safe, and to have fun, and to just bless everyone, keep everyone safe, and help everything to go good. Keep everyone safe. Thank you. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. And that's our traditional prayer that we always start our conventions with. And, well, we'll see you next episode. This is Philip Wesley, the Mile High Mouth, signing out for May 30th, 2013. And I still need to figure out how I'm going to end these things.
Your patience.
Ladies and gentlemen,
welcome to SANA, the Summit for Anime North America. This is put on by the Japanese Consulate and the Rocket Mountain Anime Association. So we appreciate it. This is the only meeting of its type in the world, as far as we can tell. We did some internet searches and came up with nothing, so we think we're pretty good. And we're going to sit here for quite a while,
for a little bit.
We're going to discuss anime in North America, its effects, its need for being, essentially. It's going to be some really, really good stuff. I have notes. I should probably read my notes, huh? All right. Let me read that. Thank you for everybody for coming out in the slightly inclement weather. You know, some people think 10 inches of snow is a thing, not in Colorado. We run all the time, and we appreciate you being here. We appreciate you coming from near and far to be here today. It's going to be a whole ton of fun. At the registration desk, there's going to be a small little survey that the Japanese consulate, bless our hearts, would like you to fill out to see how we're doing for SANA and what kind of feedback we can get from you guys. So if you want, well, please, sometime during today, go find one of those surveys and fill them out for me. That'd be fantastic. I do appreciate that. Here we have guests. Oh my god, we have guests. Great. We do have a slight change to the schedule, ladies and gentlemen. Kevin McKeever, bless his heart, is still flying in from LA, and boy, are his arms tired. I'm making that joke now, so when he does it, y'all can groan collectively. It'll be a whole ton of fun. So we're switching Ian Condry. Ian Condry's going to be the last guy before lunch, the most important part. And then we'll have Kevin McKeever going and starting up after lunch, okay? So be aware that that change is going to happen. But for now, we're going to get this thing going. I'm going to invite up to the stage one of our dear friends. We met her last night. It's absolutely fantastic. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage Dr. Lisa Friedman.